Okay, if you did the reading this week, I certainly hope that you have. You will recognize that really for about 3 weeks now, this will be the third, we're in sort of a great transition period. We are watching the end of one reign and the beginning of another, and simultaneously looking at a large number of psalms, which, if they were not written at this particular time, at least were certainly written by some of the characters that are involved, as well as dealing with some of the events that are involved. And so for 3 weeks, essentially, we've been at the same place in history, but it is an extremely important one. So this week we are reading pages 440 through 455, which was bringing us up then at the end, 1 Kings chapter 4, which we'll look at in just a minute. So, what is this time frame? Give me a nice round number. 1,050. What happened in 1,050? In 1,050, Saul became king, okay? Saul became king in that year, and really I think we can be quite certain that it's that year or awfully close to it. So it is a nice easy number to remember. We start with Saul in 1050. How long did Saul reign? 40 years. So when did Saul die? Another round number, 40 years later, would be 1010. If Saul is now dead in 1010, then who replaces him as king? David becomes king in what year? 1010. How long does David reign? Well, that's convenient. So what year does David die? 970. You better get that smartphone out and go to the calculator page. It's funny. I struggle with these every time. I have to stop and think just like you do because we're backing up. It's all B.C. So in 970, who becomes king? Solomon becomes king. How long does Solomon reign? Isn't that easy to remember? And I think they're real years. I don't think they're symbolic. I don't think, you know, that they've been stretched by any appreciable amount. And they reign for that length of time. Which then would bring us to the death of Solomon when? At 9, he reigns for how many years? Okay, so in 930, Solomon will die. At what point in this are we right now? Who became king in 1050? Who became king in 1010? Who becomes king in 970? So where are we? Right here, about 970 years before Jesus will be born, which is 2,970 years, essentially, ago. We are real close to 3,000 years that transpired since this wonderful time where the Father hands off the reins of the kingdom to His Son. Where this ultimately righteous man, after God's own heart, who has also known several titanic sins, comes to the end of his days, and with much prayer and forethought for his son, establishes who in 970 as king? Solomon becomes king. We've been watching now, really, the handing off of those responsibilities. You have a hand up there, Bill?
Speaking about David in Chronicles, gloss over everything bad and only told the good stuff. And it made me wonder, could the Chronicles all be composed by the individual king's own court chronicler?
It's quite possible that these kings each have their own chronicler. But again, we've talked about this before, and I really dislike the idea of glossing over anything. You're right. I have actually used that word, I think, you know, suggesting that the chroniclers, you know, were concealing various aspects of these kings' lives. I don't think that's the case at all. They simply have different viewpoints. They have different purposes. They are still writing the absolute truth. You know, what these uninspired authors have suggested, you know, that somebody was trying to hide is on the pages of the same Bible you're holding in your hands. You know, it's recorded in the other passage. So nothing's being hidden by any means whatsoever. As far as who the actual writers are in this case, of course, we do not know. But likely, you have, as Bill has suggested, perhaps several that are writing during the times of each one of them, you know, and carrying forward as a king's scribe. Okay, now, we're going to step back in time just a little bit tonight, back into last week's material. And as you can see from numbers on the screen, Numbers chapter 16 and verse 49, considerably farther back than that. 1649 of Numbers says that those who died by the plague were 14,700. See, I've got an extra comma in there. Besides those who died on account of Korah. This is when we first learn about this man, Korah, number 16. 10 chapters later, in Numbers 26, verses 9 through 11, Dathan and Abiram contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up along with Korah when the fire devoured 250 men, so that they became a warning. The sons of Korah, however, what does verse 11 say? Did not die. So Numbers 26 is talking about the very same event that you have recorded in Numbers 16. But what we learn there is that only the fathers and only the actual adult men that had rebelled against Moses' leadership will perish in the event, you know, the fire and the ground opening up and all of that. But there was a plague that followed as well. And the total number of 14,700. But out of 14,700 some odd people, nearly 15,000 people, who are we specifically told did not die? The immediate sons of Korah. The family was not wiped out, as many families have been when such sins are committed. This phrase, sons of Korah, which is not the least bit really significant back in Numbers chapter 26, though, becomes very important to us in much later years, doesn't it? Who are the sons of Korah now in David's day? They are the musicians and the singers. They are responsible for this form of worship. They are writing some of the psalms, not a large number, but a significant number. And so this phrase then in Numbers 26 is just a historical record of the children of the men who rebelled and died. The sons didn't. But later it becomes more of a formal kind of a term referring to a particular group of individuals who are responsible for a vastly important aspect of the Old Testament system of worship. Now, if you'll step back, just a couple pages before the actual reading this week, to page 436, let's read this transition regarding the sons of Korah there in the lower right-hand corner of page 436. Among the lists of Levites in Chronicles, so all the sons of Korah are in the tribe of Levi, two groups receive particular attention. First is the Levitical singers, led by Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun. The second are the gatekeepers. It's hard to be sure what duties were assigned to these gatekeepers, but 1 Chronicles 26 identifies them with the group that are called the Korahites. Well, of course, sons of Korah then, descendants of Korah. The superscriptions of many psalms refer to this group, associating those psalms with the sons of Korah. The psalms of the sons of Korah are Numbers 42 through 49, and then 84, 85, and 87. So it's 42 through 49, 84, 85, 87, as well as two others, Psalm 15 and 24, not attributed to the sons of Korah, but those two also, speak of the requirements for entry into the temple and thus seem appropriate for gatekeepers. Psalm 43, while it does not have a superscription, is clearly a continuation of 42, which is ascribed to the sons of Korah. Psalm 88 is associated with Heman, the Ezrahite, as well as the sons of Korah, if you were to look over at another note that they give you right there. But all I just want to point out right here is that thanks to this transition, we're recognizing the position of prominence and respectability and importance that these sons of Korah held. And in this 1 Chronicles chapter 26, we're giving a great deal of information about them. So if you look at page 436, 1 Chronicles 26, what's the little title they put on the chapter? The Gatekeepers. They were not just these great song leaders and psalm writers, but they had a physical responsibility that is directly associated with this coming temple that's now already associated with them. And apparently, not sure what all the duties are about, but it sure looks like if you wanted to come into the enclosure around which the tabernacle at first, but not the actual curtains, larger one built later by David, as well as the enclosure surrounding the temple, and again, you're not going in the temple itself, but in the courtyards, you want to get into this complex, who are you going to have to get past? You got to go by, through the gatekeepers somehow. Now, on page 437, in the transition we just read, it mentions these two psalms, 15:1 and 24:3. So, on 15, verse 1, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? This is one of those references that we read in the transition. It has to do with coming up to this higher place, the hill, where the tabernacle, set there by David, and then the temple by Solomon, was. But in that case, it seems more metaphorical, doesn't it? It really does to me. I'd like to dwell in that tabernacle. I like to think that I can, verse 2, walk uprightly and work righteousness and speak truth in my heart and not backbite or do evil to my neighbor. As you scan the psalm, it doesn't look to me like that one is very physically or geographically oriented. Look now at Psalm 24:3. Same page. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? Well, in my mind, that one actually is a little bit stronger, and it has the idea of how can you approach and abide. They are somewhat related to temple verses. But now as we come to the actual reading for this week itself, on page 440, look at Psalm 48, which is only one little verse at the tail end of the page there, right-hand column, right at the bottom. So 440, Psalm 48, verse 1, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, where? In the city of our God. In his what? Holy mountain. Beautiful in what? Elevation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, which was the north of the city of David, the city of the great king. God is in her palaces. He is known as her refuge. Well, now that really is getting very physical, isn't it? I think certainly that it is. And if you'll scan with me, and I know this will be hard to pick out. I marked mine in blue so they leap right off the page. I cheated. But now that we have already in these first three verses mentioned the city of our God, Mount Zion, and the palaces, skip down that first column on 441 to verse 9, and right at the end, what is mentioned? Your temple. And then in verse 12, a little later, walk about Zion. Go all around her. Count her towers. Mark well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces. And if you'll turn the page to 442, and there in the second verse of Psalm 84, left-hand column, Psalm 84, verse 2, my soul longs, yes, even faints for the courts of the Lord. And in verse 3, next to the last line in verse 3, your altars, O Lord of hosts. And at the top, still in Psalm 84, the right-hand column in verse 10, a day in your courts is better than 1,000. That would be 1,000 outside those courts. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell where? In the tents of wickedness. And then lastly on page 443 in Psalm 87, verse 1, his foundation is in the holy mountains. The Lord loves the what? The gates of Zion. Well, now we've scanned through this first set of the sons of Korah's psalms. And what did we find coming up time and time again? Approaching
the location of God's presence. Coming through gates and counting towers, and the city itself is mentioned, as well as this location for God, His tabernacle, and His temple. For my part, I'm thinking, and I complained about this, I think, last week as well, that possibly these psalms might have been saved for a little bit later, because at the historical moment where they placed these psalms, is there a temple yet? No, there is not. David moved the tabernacle up on Mount Moriah. So, location, we call the Temple Mount to this day. But David doesn't build a temple. And what they're talking about here, the very physical and glorious nature of what's been built, suggests to me that these psalms by the sons of Korah, who are the gatekeepers of the temple, which we were told in the reading specifically, there's one on each side, there's four gates that come into the temple complex. These psalms appear to me to have been written a little bit later than the historical information. But they are very personal, where we saw David's psalms being very personal. These psalms are also personal. They are coming out of the minds of men who have been placed in a very important office by King David himself. And then they see David's son build up this temple complex, and they begin a very formal and localized worship that will last. See who's really good. We'll, in this case, not ask Ron for any mathematical equations. But if Solomon builds the temple starting the day they put the crown on his head, then when did he become king? 970. Okay? 970. All right? And if he builds that temple, it'll take years to do it, but we'll start with 970. So it's 970 B.C. And that temple will be completely demolished in 586. We'll round off the numbers, and we'll call it 980 and 580. How many years is that? 400 years. Solomon's temple will stand for real close to 400 years. This is quite a moment in the history of Israel. It is the moment when their wisest of all kings will take the throne. It is the moment when the fruition of all of David's organizational prowess will be established and begin to function. It is the moment in history in which God will take up His glorious residence, the footstool for His feet, there on Mount Zion in Israel, Mount Moriah, actually two adjoining mountains. Moriah is where the temple itself is, you know, but in the city of Jerusalem on Mount Zion. And we will have 400 years of this temple. This temple was well built. And in the reading you found out, extremely expensively built as well. And the sons of Korah just love the responsibility they've got. They write psalms about it, and they talk about it, and they glorify it. They were living at the pinnacle of Israel's glory. They were living at the time when the temple was not 100 years old, or 200 years old, or 300 years old. They were living and writing psalms at the time that it was 1 year old, and 2 years old, and 3 years old, and that city had become the wonder of the world, the glory of God. If you will look at the screen, you can go all over the internet and find the various trumpets and cymbals, and in this case a lyre and other instruments depicted as we see from various, like the bas reliefs that are in the palace at Nineveh that have been discovered from the Assyrians. And so these kinds of things have been reconstructed, of course. But let's look on page 440 now at Psalm 46, which is the first of these that's listed here in our reading this week. First in this week, Psalm 46 of the sons of Korah. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, there is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. So, as soon as you wake up, God's there to help. The nations raged. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. What is that psalm about? It is just, you know, a triumphant song of faith. I don't care if the mountains disappear. I don't care if the Mediterranean is tsunami. I don't care. God, from the moment I open my eyes in the morning, is for me. He will protect me. He will protect us. He will protect this city. We are the people of God. It's one of the more beautiful psalms that comes now, not, of course, from David, but from son of Korah, who is enjoying the prominence of this city and its temple at this, you know, most precious time in Israel's history. Now, Psalm 49, which is on page 441, and we're going to start there at verse 13, though. In Psalm 49, another psalm of the sons of Korah, let's read verses 13 and 14 and 15. This is the way of those who are foolish, and of their posterity, who approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them. The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall be consumed in the grave, far from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall what? Receive me. Now I'm going to do this every chance I get, because this wretched and divisive and destructive and pernicious doctrine known as realized eschatology, you know, really gets my hackles up. It rankles me. Okay. So this whole idea that there are no resurrection passages in the Old Testament is just silly. Read that passage several more times. Maybe read that passage before you go to sleep tonight, so you can wake up with Psalm 46 on your list and also recognize with this psalm on your list, three psalms later, that whatever happens in this life, up to and including the day that you die, is the grave the end of it for you? For the wicked, it sure looks to be. Death feeds on them, and their beauty is consumed. But there's a great contrast that goes on here. You get redeemed. You get received. You are not consumed, destroyed, or remaining in that tomb. You're coming out some one of these days. Now, on page 443, I want to read that transition at the bottom of the first column, David's counsel to Solomon. As I say, I might have rearranged this just a little bit differently myself. We've already read about David's death, and now we're coming back and reading about his last words, so I might have done it, you know, a little more linearly and chronologically, but nonetheless, here it says, under David's counsel to Solomon, the organization of David's kingdom concludes in 1 Chronicles 26:20 through 27:34 with lists of the temple treasurers, judicial officers, military captains and officers, tribal officers, administrators, and counselors. There were quite a few different offices that were set up. And some had to do with soldiers that had to protect the physicality of this glorious and very expensive and valuable temple complex that David knew was about to be built. David is credited, it continues, with organizing Israel's religious life, military power,
and civil government. One thing remained, building the temple. Both Samuel and Kings, referring to the books of Samuel and Kings, and Chronicles, agree that David did not build the temple. Solomon, his son and successor, did that. The two accounts differ, however, in the extent to which David is involved. The chronicler spares no effort to show that David did everything except build the temple. When David hands over the building plans to Solomon, 1 Chronicles 28, verse 11, it is clear that the chronicler sees David, not his son, as the true founder of the temple. So Bill pointed out a little while ago, you know, there's differences in the record, but they're all telling the true story, just different aspects of it. We highlighted this, I think, you know, last week as well. I guess I'm like the chronicler. I really like David getting the credit for this. So you remember how I did that. Solomon built it. But in the end, what was Solomon? As far as the temple building goes, what was Solomon?
He just followed David's
plans. He was just a glorified CEO, you know, who already had the plans and all the materials and simply said, okay, guys, go build it. And I rather doubt that he was out there, you know, working it daily himself on any of the stone for this thing, the cedar and the rest of it.
I always like to think that this is the first recording of a prefab. They must have gone into this because there weren't any saws, no hammers in the building of the temple. All done somewhere else and brought in and put together like a jigsaw.
That's right. That's a great point. Now, there was a time when I thought I'd like to live in a log cabin, and then I started, I've done four or five meetings now in Illinois, Indiana, and I live with just a wonderful couple, an elder and his wife, you know, in one of those log cabin things, and decided, you know, there's just a little more maintenance upkeep than that, and I really care to get into, you know, to learn my lesson. But it's exactly what you're talking about. If you do buy one of those log houses, do they come out and cut trees off of your property? Very seldom. Do they go out and carve the logs up and put them in place? You know, is it like Jeremiah Johnson?
No.
What do they do? They bring a tree to a building site. They put the whole thing together. And then what do? Take it apart, put it on trucks, bring it out where you're going, and assemble the whole thing again. Up in Washington, Don and I frequently, there were two of them right on the freeway we used all the time. And we would see various stages of these houses for years being built up. And then one day, all of a sudden, they were gone. How did this? They trucked it off somewhere. So you've got an outstanding point, Ron. That's exactly it. It's built off-site. God is so holy, he wants to be so revered and respected that he is not going to allow the sound of chainsaws on his property. You're going to build it somewhere else, and then you're going to bring it. It was this marvelous thing that was done. But all the forethought, all the planning, all the collection of the materials, you know, everything was done by whom?
David.
David, not Solomon. Solomon just had the plans handed to him and got busy then. So there's that transition on page 443, helping us to appreciate that. And now if you'll come to page 445, I want to read a lengthy section, Bill. Yes? That is correct. Yeah. David did the planning. David got all the materials together. David's responsible for what it is. Solomon gives the orders and actually builds the thing itself. He's the one to stack it up on site.
David didn't do all the planning. If you look at the bottom of page 445, verse 19, it says, "All this said David, the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me all the works of these plans."
Who built the temple, brethren? God built the temple. Okay. Who gave David the plans? God. Who made Solomon build it? Got me good. Stop doing that. It's God's temple. And in the end, all of them are just what? The contractors he hired and sent out there to get the job done. That is why it was so astonishingly beautiful. But to be sure, who first had the idea to build that temple? David, and then it failed because man of blood. All right, let's read about it. In 1 Chronicles 28, we're at the very top of page 445, and we're going to read starting there in verse 2. King David rose to his feet. Even though this is at the very end of his life, and we've already read about how terribly sick he was at the very end, he either summoned strength, or it's just before the end days. As a matter of fact, my dad died three and a half years ago. He was on his feet, and he was working in the yard, and he was getting on his tractor and doing what had to be done for those horses around those 5 acres until 5 days before he died. 5 days before he died, it was over. He came in the house, he got in the bed, and that was the end. Took 5 days before he died. But like David, right to the end, and I hope I can get within 5 days of my last breath, that's what I'm hoping for, then, you know, this apparently is what's happening with David. It's right at the end, but he's still able to get up on his feet, and he said, "Hear me, my brethren and my people. I had it in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God, and had made preparations to build it. But God said to me," and by the way, how did God speak to him? Nathan was sent. Through Nathan, he heard these words, "You shall not build a house for my name, because you have been a man of war and have shed blood. However, the Lord God of Israel chose me above all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. For he has chosen Judah to be the ruler. And of the house of Judah, the house of my father," who is David's father, by the way? "My firstborn son was named after him, Jesse." Okay, that's the house of Judah. "House of my father, and among the sons of my father, he was pleased with me to make me king over all Israel. And of all my sons, for the Lord has given me many sons." He had at least how many wives? He had 8 that we have names for. He had a lot of sons. "He has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel." Was Solomon the firstborn? No. But he was chosen. "Now, he said to me, 'It is your son Solomon who shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Moreover, I will establish his kingdom forever if he is steadfast to observe my commandments and my judgments as it is this day.'" Skip down to verse 10, last of the next paragraph. "Consider now," David's still speaking, "for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it." Who's David talking to now? Solomon, very personally himself. Verse 11, "And David gave his son Solomon the plans for the vestibule, its houses, its treasuries," note the plurality so far, "its upper chambers, its inner chambers, and the place of the mercy seat, and the plans for all that he had by the," Bob Johnston, "spirit of the courts of the house of the Lord, of all the chambers, all around, of the treasuries of the house of God, and of the treasuries for the dedicated things, also for the division of the priests and the Levites, for all the work of the service of the house of the Lord, and for all the articles of the service in the house of the Lord." So once again, and likewise, David made a lot of lists. He did an awful lot of organizing. We've read a whole lot about all these different things, you know, that David did. But now again, what are we being told? Where did he get the list? He got the list from his God. Everything that's being done here is being done by inspiration. Now, to skip to the last verse on that page, verse 19. "All this," said David, "the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me all the works of these plans." Now, if I understand that correctly, and you look at it, see what you think. But what I think I'm seeing there is that David actually gave us a fair amount of insight into the very precise manner in which he received these plans. And that is, he sat down at a piece of paper, and then what does that verse say God did? Revealed it to him by writing. So it appears that he just started writing, and what came out of that pen
was God's words on that paper, and that's how it was revealed to David. Now, I'm not totally sure about this, but the way it reads, at least here in the New King James Version to me, would be that David begins to write. When does he find out what this revelation is?
When he's not writing.
When he writes it himself. He's reading it while he writes it. That's how he's finding out about it. So he's kind of an amazing moment in history, I suspect, in which this revelation now has come to him. No prophet involved this time. David's writing it down. So, you know, on the slide, we have in this wondrous passage here, in this particular chapter, we have the emphasis upon God being the originator, the designer, you know, the motivator behind all this. We have David having ideas that he is having, apparently, himself, as well as being placed in his mind miraculously and by inspiration. We have the involvement of Solomon as well, who we've just been told is a most upright and righteous individual. If he'll just stay that way and continue keeping the commandment, then descendants for all generations to come will sit on that throne. And then we're starting to find out about the temple itself. This week's reading was an amazing moment in Israel's history. They are moving permanently now from the last vestiges of even appearing to be a nomadic people who are Hebrews, who are sojourners. What are they now? They are a kingdom. They are a nation. They are a people. And they're going to have the wonder of the world temple that would put to shame anything that had ever been built before, and it'll stand for 400 years. Now, I'm going to give you just a couple of slides here, so up to the screen for a moment. This is one artist's depiction of what David's Jerusalem would have looked like, and I really like this one, because if you look closely, you can see this trail going up right here, all the way up to that little white dot. See, that is Mount Moriah. David's city, the city of David, is the old Jebusite city. There was a good tall hill on the north end. South is over here, north is over there on this one. It's just put at a 45-degree angle. David built this city. David walled this city. David built a palace right on the north end of that city. David continued using the Gihon springs that the Jebusites had been using, but put a wall around it so the springs now protected and defended. And then has a permanent water source. But David was limiting himself to half of this Mount Moriah. The lower southern slopes was David's job. He could build and fortify the city. He built a palace, which I've shown you repeatedly, is coming to light right now. The archaeologists are digging deeper and deeper, you know, into the Givati parking lot, I think they call it, actually, is the site there. But, you know, this is one artist's rendition. And so the Kidron Valley is running all along the side right here. And here's the high part of the mountain. The valley's coming down like that. Now, keep watching the slide. Here's another artist's rendition, a pencil sketch this time. Now, see, nobody knows how extensive the city was. But, again, this gives you a really good picture of this Kidron Valley, David building on the lower slope with his palace on the north end, and then Mount Moriah comes up. And that mountain most likely came to quite the pointy peak at the top, and it's there, it's what this is depicting, that David put the tabernacle. So, in the old days, how long ago is this in the roughest of terms? 3,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, the valleys were much deeper, the mountain was much taller, David was working on the first really extensive construction of the site. So, he's not just taking the lay of the land and building a wall, he's moving dirt. He is excavating like we do today when we go to build a house. And so, things are going to be changing and changing dramatically. The Jerusalem that we see today, topographically, very different. That's still the Kidron Valley, you know, that's still Mount Moriah, But what would Solomon do to the top of Mount Moriah? He would cut it off flat and build a huge temple complex. And then, for 46 years, what would Herod the Great do just before Jesus comes on the scene? He's going to build a far larger temple complex. He's going to take 35 acres and take more off the mountaintop, build an enormous retaining wall, so Mount Moriah had just kept getting shorter. Okay? Today, it's not all that high at all in relation to where David's palace was and what they're excavating right now. But back in David's day, it would have been a pretty significantly, higher climb to get up on top of that mountain. Now, here's an aerial photograph of what it looks like today. I realize, again, it's hard for you to see from much of a distance here. But this looks, because of these two roads right here, for all the world, like the tail end of Florida. That is the city of David. And then, right here are the walls of the city, right here, and of the Temple Mount right there. So that, from David's palace, here's that divided parking lot, David's palace is apparently all this area right here. Used to be, he'd have to go way up hill, get up here, then through the years, it's all been brought down, cleared off, huge retaining wall, over 100 feet where the dirt, is filled in, 35 acres wide, now we have the Temple Mount. But the old Kidron Valley, you can sure see here, can't you? And what's everything on the right? Mount of Olives. Okay? So, David got it started. David stayed down here. The Gihon Springs, about right there. So he's, doing all this. And then, back in those days, they estimate that the valley floor you see right here was 60 feet deeper than it is today. Rome came in 70 AD, and they took everything back down again. And they threw all the rubble everywhere, and they just, like ants on an anthill, they just, threw everything over. And it's figured that it's some 60 feet higher today than it was back then. Now, a couple more slides, and we'll get back to the text itself and close out our class. But this particular map shows us, in that purple color, Saul's kingdom. So their first king, who became king in... reigned until 10. That king, Saul, reigned from Dan to Beersheba. Okay? So all this purple right here is his kingdom. Had problems with the Philistines, couldn't do so much over there with the Ammonites and Moabites, all that war going on, but the purple stuff, that's Saul. Now, if we zoom out on that same map, on the left-hand side is everything inside here. The rest of the map is what David conquered in the green. Solomon would extend this brown area clear back up in here. It is 40 miles from Dan to Damascus. My red thing, I don't know if I can get rid of it or not. I just can't. Right underneath this line right here is Damascus. It's 40 miles from Dan to Damascus right there. So that's 40 miles. Okay. One, two, three, four. There's something between 160 and 200 miles, something like that, that they've got expanding the kingdom. From Dan to Beersheba is 150 miles. That's not all that far. The kingdom doubled under David in square miles. It doubled. And then another probably 30%. Was added by Solomon. And then, Solomon, as you'll be reading, established an empire that makes Donald Trump look tiny. Okay. He was the master merchant. And throughout the whole Mediterranean, throughout all the surrounding nations, to the east as well, Solomon was trading and became the wealthiest man of all that time during 40 years of all 40 years, in complete peace and harmony. Okay, so back to the text itself now. We're on page 446, and very bottom right-hand column. Let's start reading from 1 Chronicles 29,
verse 21, which we'll spill on over into page 447. So Solomon is anointed king. They made sacrifices to the Lord and offered burnt offerings to the Lord on the next day. 1,000 bulls, 1,000 rams, 1,000 lambs with their drink offerings and sacrifices in abundance for all Israel. So they ate and drank before the Lord with great gladness on that day. And they made Solomon, the son of David, king. And this is curious statement there. King the what? He'd already been made king. Adonijah had made a play for the throne. He'd been put down. There were all kinds of problems that we've already read about. Bathsheba had to hurry into the throne room, you know, beg, you know, I thought you said my son was going to be king. It was really hard. But then, after they got that established, David was still functioning. He could still get up on his feet. He was still making plans for the temple. Now, we're coming down to the end of David's life, the very bitter end. They have a second ceremony in which Solomon is the king. Verse 23, Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord as king instead of David his father, and prospered, and all Israel obeyed him. All the leaders and the mighty men, and also the sons of King David, submitted themselves to King Solomon. So the Lord exalted Solomon exceedingly in the sight of all Israel, and bestowed on him royal majesty as had not been on any king before him in Israel. Well, how many kings were before him? Only two. But they both reigned for 40 years, and they both had extensive kingdoms. They were both pretty powerful. They're both pretty wealthy. So they both had done pretty well for themselves. But when Solomon hit the scene, nobody could hold a candle to him. Now, continuing the reading, the close of David's reign, verse 26, thus David, the son of Jesse, reigned over all Israel, and the period that he reigned over Israel was 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem. So actually it's 40 and a half. So he died at a good old age, full of days and riches and honor, and Solomon his son reigned in his place. Now, the acts of King David, first and last, indeed they are written in the book of Samuel the seer. Do we have that book? Yeah, we do. In the book of Nathan the prophet. Do we have that book? No, we don't. And in the book of Gad the seer. Do we have that book? No, we don't. With all his reign and his might and the events that happened to him in Israel and to all the kingdoms of the lands. So, of the three books that are mentioned, God chose to preserve one, thus proving that since we don't have the books of Nathan and Gad, you should burn your Bible and never read it again. It's the way most people behave. Well, the missing books of the Bible. Yeah, well, okay. Yeah. Okay. But I'll tell you what. When I die, thanks to the fact that in my lifetime digital cameras were invented, it'll take you years to look at all my pictures. I took close to 4,000 of them on one trip to Israel. I got more than that from Pharaoh on that trip. I took his disc too. That's just the start. And I got the kids. Okay? So if you go and you look at some of the pictures of my life, and there's one whole file folder that you never look at, does that prove I never existed? Does that prove that you can't know anything about me or have any idea what kind of a man I was or who my children were or anything? Yeah, it proves nothing. So don't let people bamboozle you. You know, this kind of silliness. God himself is saying, there were these other books. Other people were writing. The people of the time can do that too. And by the way, if you're living in that time, do you have to read anybody about it? Well, no, because what? You're looking at it. We have the record of Kings and Chronicles that tells us about it now. That's all you need. So don't let that kind of stuff, you know, be a problem for you. Now, coming very close to the end, got just a couple of minutes left. On page 447, we have Psalm number 2, and on the screen, I've given you Acts chapter 4.
So let's just read from Acts 4 here, verses 23 through 28, where Psalm 2 is quoted. Being let go, so Peter and John got out of the arrest, they went to their own, I believe that's the apostles and not a whole lot of other people, and reported all that the chief priests and elders had said. So when they heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, you are God. Almost sounds like a psalm. Who made heaven and earth and sea and all that's in them. Who by the mouth of your servant David have said. Now, on page 447, what do you notice about the title of Psalm 2? Are there any italicized words? Psalm of David, Sons of Korah, do you get any of that kind of stuff? No. There is no superscription on Psalm 2 in the ancient Jewish copies of the Bible. But what does this say? By the mouth of your servant David have said, why did the nations rage and the people plot vain things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For truly, against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, were gathered together to do whatever your hand and your purpose determined before to be done. Okay? Who wrote Psalm 2? And you have the inspired declaration that he did. So, back in your regular study Bible, you got to write that down on Psalm 2. Acts 4, 23 through 28, quotes the first three verses and tells you emphatically in the passage, just before the quote, David wrote the psalm. And it is, of course, a messianic psalm. Now, Psalm 449 is our last slide for the day. And Psalm 72, I just wanted to make a note, and especially for Jerry's sake, I'm really glad he's here tonight and the rest of our Bible scholars, but I noticed something for the first time ever that I just wanted to ask about, see what you think about. Please note that in the superscription, an uninspired addition to the psalm itself that came maybe hundreds of years later, but in the uninspired superscription, this is a psalm written by whom? I'm not so sure. I used to think that until studying for this class. Psalm of Solomon. That phrase, of Solomon, brethren, a psalm of Solomon, could be interpreted or understood that it could mean a psalm by Solomon. It is of Solomon in the sense that he is its author. But it only just hit me this week that it could also be about Solomon. If it's a psalm of Solomon, it could be a psalm about Solomon as much as it could be a psalm written by Solomon. What struck me, and I had never noticed before, is on page 449, right in the middle of the right-hand column. What does verse 20 say, the last verse of Psalm 72? The prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are what? Ended. Now, if you look in your regular Bible, most of them will show the five books of Psalms. Talked about that a lot, haven't we? Five books of Psalms. Psalm 72 is the last one in the third book. So it may be that this line, the prayers of David are ended, was intended to be between Psalm 72 and 73 as a statement that David wrote most of them. But as we saw tonight, who else wrote Psalms? Sons of Korah wrote Psalms, or other men that wrote Psalms that are in those books as well. So just so you think about it, you hit me for the first time, wait a minute, if that's a psalm about Solomon, and it's a prayer by his father David, then go home and read that tonight. Wow, that might be David speaking to Solomon like we just read that he did at the end of his life as he charges him with the responsibility to be a faithful and upright king over Israel.